Chapter 15. Above the Clouds. When Grant reached the headquarters of General George Thomas on the dark, rainy night of October 23rd, he was spent and bedraggled from his arduous journey. To those who set eyes on the sodden general, he seemed to be stoically grappling with pain. "As he arose and walked across the floor," said a spectator, "his lameness was very perceptible." Grant's initial encounter with the Rock of Chickamauga was frosty. As the two men sat wordlessly beside a fireplace, Grant smoked a cigar and hunched forward quietly, water trickling from his mud-spattered clothes, forming a puddle beneath his chair. Thomas, who was loyal to Rosecrans and thought Grant had treated him disgracefully, seemed unconcerned with his new commander's wretched state. "Rawlins was white with anger at the cool reception the general and staff had received," said James H. Wilson. "They had made a long and tiresome ride and were soaking wet, but as yet nothing had been done to relieve their discomfort." Wilson piped up, "General Thomas, General Grant has been on the road 2 days. He is wet and suffering from a bruised leg. Besides, he is tired and hungry. Can't you get him some dry clothes from one of your staff and order some supper to be provided for him?" Reminded of his duty, the courtly Virginian replied, "Of course I can," and he extended dry clothes and an ample supper to Grant. Grant's rough-hewn style had an impact upon a man destined to be a key aide, Captain Horace Porter, who had graduated third in his West Point class in 1860. The images he had seen of Grant made him envision a burly beef contractor, not the gentle, slightly stooped man who stood 5'8" and weighed 135 pounds. Porter picked up many subtle traits, how Grant thoughtfully stroked his beard, the perceptible twinkle in his eyes when he was about to utter something amusing, the square-shaped jaws that expressed his willpower, the creased brow that disclosed a serious and somewhat careworn mood behind an otherwise cheerful facade, his surprisingly clear, melodious voice, his slow, rolling gait, and how he behaved civilly to everyone, never snubbing those of lesser rank. But it was the mind, beautifully organized and well-prepared, that most dazzled Porter as a torrent of ideas suddenly issued from this reputedly silent man. A keen listener and close observer, Grant began to fire whole volleys of questions at the officers present. So intelligent were his inquiries, so pertinent his suggestions, that he made a profound impression upon everyone by the quickness of his perception and the knowledge which he had already acquired regarding important details of the Army's condition. Grant's instant grasp of complicated logistical issues astounded Porter. With a reticence reminiscent of Grant, Thomas had a cool relationship with him. The commander of the 45,000-strong Army of the Cumberland had a broad, meaty face, bushy beard, tensely arched brows, set mouth, and stern gaze. With his dignified manner, commanding appearance, and superb judgment, "He had more the character of George Washington than any other man I ever knew," said Dana. Unlike Robert E. Lee, the heavyset Virginian had decided that the treasonous nature of secession surpassed loyalty to his home state and stayed with the Union. As Grant recalled from West Point, Thomas had been tarred with the name Old Slow Trot. He had a spinal injury that forced him to gallop slowly, which got to the heart of Grant's dilemma with him. Thorough in preparation for battle, dogged on defense, Thomas swung into action reluctantly. "He is possessed of excellent judgment, great coolness and honesty, but he is not good on a pursuit," concluded Grant, who often said, "Thomas is too slow to move and too brave to run away." Despite an absence of personal warmth between them, Grant carefully paid homage to his colleague in public, later calling him one of the great names of our history, one of the greatest heroes in our war, a rare and noble character in every way worthy of his fame. The morning after his arrival in Chattanooga, Grant mounted his horse and scouted the terrain with Thomas and his chief engineer, Brigadier General William Farrar Baldy Smith. Surprisingly enough, riding in the coming days completely healed Grant's leg, and he soon dispensed with a cane. Lincoln assigned high priority to retaining the town, viewing it as an entryway to the industrial heartland of the South, the booming arsenals and factories of Georgia and Alabama. Things looked pretty ghastly as Grant took stock. Chattanooga stood at the northern end of a valley bounded by Missionary Ridge, a steep slope that rose as high as 400 feet to the east, and Lookout Mountain to the southwest, which soared 1,400 feet above the valley floor. With both heights manned by Confederates, Union troops were bottled up down below without ammunition for a single day's fighting. As Baldy Smith observed, the rebel army believed that they held the Union army at their mercy, and its destruction was only a question of time. Grant could see why. It looked indeed as if but two courses were open, one to starve, the other to surrender or be captured. Since nearly 10,000 horses and mules had perished from starvation, not a single draft animal remained to haul artillery or transport the sick. Desperate soldiers, subsisting on half rations of leathery meat and hard bread, prowled the ground searching for scraps of corn or oats. Many faced cold weather without shoes and overcoats, and had felled virtually every tree for fuel, even grubbing up stumps in their desperation. Sick soldiers were stashed away in makeshift hospitals. All the while, enemy pickets patrolled less than 100 yards away in some places. The first order of business, Grant concluded, was to restore health and troop morale by prying open a new water and land route to bring in food from the key rail juncture at Bridgeport, Alabama. The Union Army controlled the railroad all the way from Nashville to that spot. The new route would be nicknamed the Cracker Line, a tribute to the hard biscuits munched by the men. Smith and others had devised a plan to seize control of the Serpentine Tennessee River at a point north of Lookout Mountain. Supplies would be taken by a direct wagon road to a spot known as Brown's Ferry, shifted across the Tennessee by pontoon bridge, then moved across a spit of land known as Moccasin Bend. However torturous this route seemed, it promised a much shorter road to Bridgeport than the forbidding Rocky Mountain Road now inadequately serving that purpose. Grant, Thomas, and Smith inspected Brown's Ferry and confirmed that it stood well beyond the range of powerful Confederate guns staring down from Lookout Mountain. Grant gave Smith's ingenious plan his blessing and issued a host of orders to implement it. As ever, his whole physiology sprang into action, his pulse quickened, his mind sharpened. And Porter remembered a dynamo of concentrated energy that night. He sat with his head bent low over the table, and when he had occasion to step to another table or desk to get a paper he wanted, he would glide rapidly across the room without straightening himself and return to his seat with his body still bent over at about the same angle at which he had been sitting when he left his chair. Upon this occasion, he tossed the sheets of paper across the table as he finished them, leaving them in the wildest disorder. When he had completed the dispatch, he gathered up the scattered sheets, read them over rapidly, and arranged them in their proper order. On the spot, Grant infused a fighting spirit into the army, and men received him with a rousing cheer as he made the rounds. He tolerated no sloppiness. That first day, he passed by soldiers packing cracker boxes into wagons in perfunctory fashion. "That won't do, men," he reprimanded them. "Those crackers are going to men who are starving. Every cracker is precious, and the more boxes you get into that wagon, the more hungry men you will feed tonight." He gestured with his crutch to indicate where more boxes could be stored. Such stories sparked new vitality in the hitherto sluggish, downcast army. On the moonlit night of October 27th, in pre-dawn hours, Grant's men, loaded on barges, slipped past Confederate positions and stealthily landed at Brown's Ferry, overwhelming a meagerly defended Confederate post. Smith's men were ferried over and handily laid down a pontoon bridge across the Tennessee River. General Hooker arrived with another 16,000 men, consolidating Union control of the area. The upshot was that Union forces broke open the route from Bridgeport to near Chattanooga, ending the isolation suffered by semi-starving Federal troops, who whooped with joy. "The cracker line's open," they cried. "Full rations, boys!" Food, clothing, and forage poured in, and suddenly Union men were better fed, better clothed, and more numerous than the rebels. This daring move threw into turmoil the Confederate camp, which shifted from confidence to alarm. "The question of supplies may now be regarded as settled," Grant telegraphed proudly to Halleck, saying he could switch his attention to offensive operations. His old logistical skills, dating back to the Mexican War, had rejuvenated the army under his command, which felt a new guiding intelligence. "We began to see things move," explained Colonel L.B. Eaton, brother of the chaplain. "We felt that everything came from a plan. Everything was done like music. Everything was in harmony." Grant strengthened the entire supply chain. Drawing on the expertise of General Grenville M. Dodge, he rebuilt 182 interior bridges, many spanning chasms, and restored 102 miles of railroad tracks destroyed by rebel armies in northern Alabama and middle Tennessee, a stupendous engineering feat often accomplished with elementary axes, picks, and spades. At Chattanooga, Grant profited from knowledge of his Confederate counterpart, Braxton Bragg, a North Carolina native and West Point graduate who had met Grant during the Mexican War and later worked as a Louisiana sugar planter. A cold martinet with a gaunt, narrow face and beetling brows, Bragg had flashing eyes that suggested his combustible temperament. However much Grant respected his professionalism, he knew he was possessed of an irascible temper and was naturally disputatious. A stickler for rules, Bragg took sadistic delight in punishing people for violations, forcing fellow soldiers to witness executions of deserters. "He loved to crush the spirit of his men," said a soldier. "Not a single soldier in the whole army ever loved or respected him." Whatever the dislike of his troops, Bragg had won significant victories at Perryville, Stones River, and Chickamauga, and never shed the unqualified trust of his main supporter, Jefferson Davis. Scarcely had Grant broken the semi-siege than reports drifted back that Bragg had made a critical error by dispatching 20,000 men under James Longstreet to attack General Ambrose Burnside and his Army of the Ohio holed up in Knoxville in eastern Tennessee. Lincoln had lavished an almost paternal regard upon the loyal residents of eastern Tennessee, reflected in a flurry of telegrams from the capital to Grant, demanding urgent action to rescue Burnside. Although Grant shared their anxiety, he felt powerless to relieve Burnside directly. He still had to wrestle with a troublesome shortage of artillery horses, and even had he posted soldiers to Burnside, there would have been no supplies or ammunition to equip them when they arrived. Stuck on the horns of this dilemma, Grant believed the most efficacious way to save Burnside was by thrashing Bragg in Chattanooga, possibly forcing him to summon Longstreet back to his side. On November 7th, Grant was tempted to pummel a weakened Bragg at Missionary Ridge until Thomas convinced him the attempt was hazardously premature due to Confederate strength and a dearth of draft animals. He also didn't know if his men were ready. In the meantime, Grant exhorted Burnside to banish any thought of retreat and hold eastern Tennessee at all costs. Working from a modest white frame house overlooking the Tennessee River, Grant believed the war hinged on saving Chattanooga, the vital point of the rebellion, as it had on Vicksburg before. By mid-November, he enjoyed robust health, having recuperated from his accident, when William Tecumseh Sherman rode into town and made a beeline for headquarters. He and his 17,000 soldiers had tramped 600 miles from Vicksburg. Grant's first action upon arriving in Chattanooga had been to telegraph Washington and request that Sherman be given command of the Army of the Tennessee with his headquarters in the field. By now, an easy camaraderie joined the two men, who immediately fell into good-natured repartee. Grant extended a cigar to Sherman, ushering him toward a rocking chair. "Take the chair of honor, Sherman." "Oh no, that belongs to you, General," Sherman retorted. Never mind that, Grant replied slyly. I always give precedence to age. Well, said the slightly older Sherman, if you put it on that ground, I must accept. And he sat down and lit a cigar. Grant held an animated discussion with Sherman and Thomas, lasting well into the night, about how best to bring Braxton Bragg to bay. The next morning, escorted by Grant and Thomas, Sherman received his first sobering glimpse of military realities in Chattanooga when they strolled out to a promontory east of town that afforded a magnificent view of the panorama, Sherman wrote. He saw rebel tents clearly stretched along Missionary Ridge and rebel flags aflutter atop Lookout Mountain, while rebel sentinels strode their posts, in plain view, not 1,000 yards off. For the first time, Sherman comprehended the dire, claustrophobic plight of Federal forces. Why, General Grant, he remarked, you are besieged. Grant confessed, it is too true. Until that moment, Sherman said, I had no idea that things were so bad. Grant gave Sherman a complete rundown of the deficiencies he dealt with, including his fear that Thomas's army, whipped at Chickamauga, had shed their fighting elan, and that Sherman's men would have to assume the offensive. Grant believed he had detected a weak link in Bragg's defenses, the northern portion of Missionary Ridge, and he and Sherman diligently reviewed the ground. The grand outline of Grant's strategy now emerged. Sherman and Hooker would attack the flanks of Bragg's position on Missionary Ridge, Sherman's attack on the northern end being the main thrust, while Thomas bulldozed the Butternut Center, then joined forces with Sherman. By November 16th, Longstreet laid siege to Burnside at Knoxville, and Grant, concerned about this situation, stayed up past midnight to fire off dispatches. At the same time, he grew increasingly sanguine about his chances against Bragg. Projecting high spirits, he retailed old war stories as he rode about inspecting fortifications. In general, he is extremely reserved, the visiting William Renshaw Smith wrote in his diary. But with one or two friends, he is very entertaining and agreeable. Charles Francis Adams, Jr. found Grant's appearance uninspiring, saying he could easily pass for a slouchy little subaltern. Yet he saw that the cool and quiet Grant radiated confidence and, in a crisis, he is one against whom all around would instinctively lean. Grant's clear sense of purpose enabled him to enlist the energies of a giant army in a common task. For good sense, strong judgment, and nerve, he cannot be surpassed, Wilson wrote. He is a tower of strength. The tower of strength struggled with one fateful flaw, his intermittent weakness for alcohol. And Rawlins did yeoman's duty policing Grant's staff to create a safe zone of sobriety around his boss. He grew irate when aide Colonel Clark B. Lagow, described by Dana as a worthless, whiskey-drinking, useless fellow, held a raucous late-night drinking party that Grant himself had to break up at 4 a.m. Smith observed the rough justice meted out by Rawlins to Lagow. He saw that General Rawlins wanted him off the staff, and after the unfortunate spree that the general himself broke up, he saw that he was treated coldly by him. He today heard his resignation had been approved and sent to Washington for acceptance. Smith arrived in camp with a bottle of wine for Grant from his mother. When he turned it over to Rawlins, the latter snapped, "Who brought that?" Smith answered, "I did. The general's mother sent it." Rawlins spluttered, "The general's family are all damn fools." That Hannah Grant sent wine to her son meant she was either unaware of his drinking history or refused to believe the prevalent stories. Grant remained inordinately proud of Rawlins, having recently boasted to Elihu Washburn that he was no ordinary man and had matured amazingly as a military strategist. As it is, he is better and more favorably known than probably any other officer in the army who has filled only staff appointments. That November, Rawlins again sounded the alarm after 2 nights of apparent drinking by Grant, writing to him with his usual messianic fervor. I again appeal to you in the name of everything a friend, an honest man, and a lover of his country holds dear, to immediately desist from further tasting of liquors of any kind. This very moment every faculty of your mind should be clear and unclouded. The enemy threatens your lines with immediate attack. Burnside, one of your generals, trembles where he stands. The authorities at Washington fear he would yield. They look to you to save him. Since the hour Washington crossed the ice-filled Delaware with his barefooted patriots to the attack of Trenton, so much of weighty responsibility has not been imposed by your government upon one man as it has now imposed upon you. Two more nights like the last will find you prostrated on a sickbed, unfit for duty. This must not be. You only can prevent it, and for the sake of my bleeding country and your own honor, I pray God you may. Upon reflection, Rawlins decided not to transmit this letter, and talked to Grant instead, believing, afterward, it had the desired effect. If Grant imbibed at this interval, it deviated from his standard pattern of drinking on side trips. Here, his army was distinctly endangered. Rawlins began to feel oppressed by the eternal burden of being Grant's watchdog. I am the only one here, his wife not being with him, who can stay the drinking and prevent evil consequences resulting from it, Rawlins told his fiancée. He was eager to visit Emma in Connecticut, but only if he could persuade the general to send for Mrs. Grant. If she is with him, all will be well and I can be spared. In that same letter, Rawlins disclosed another reason for his extreme vigilance over Grant, his dread that he himself might turn into a drunkard. I tell you, my dearest Emma, unless the blighting shadow of intemperance once had hung like a pall over one's pathway all his life and made him fear to ask himself the question, am I to die a drunkard? He can poorly appreciate my feelings on this subject. So Rawlins, under the guise of watching over Grant, seemed to be scrutinizing himself as well. That Rawlins's rebuke of Grant had a salutary effect can be seen from a comment made by Major General David Hunter, who stayed with Grant for 3 weeks, starting in Chattanooga. At the end of that period, Hunter reassured Stanton that Grant was modest, quiet, never swears, and seldom drinks, and he only took 2 drinks during the 3 weeks I was with him. By November 18th, Grant had 80,000 men and stood ready to assault Missionary Ridge, notwithstanding that he still felt handicapped by a shortage of horses and supplies. As he told an aide, I am tired of the proximity of the enemy and do not intend to stand it if it can be helped. And one more good whipping will virtually end the war. Unfortunately, I am not in a condition to give them that. The main attack was slated for November 21st, with Sherman approaching the ridge at daylight from its extreme northern end. It would be a daring amphibious undertaking. Sherman and his men would cross the Tennessee River via a long pontoon bridge and aboard 3 large rafts. Heavy rains on November 20th heaved roads around Brown's Ferry into muddy wastes, impeding Sherman's wagons, livestock, and artillery, and making it impossible for him to get into position in time for an attack the next day. To Grant's extreme frustration, it was not even certain that Sherman, despite almost superhuman efforts, would be ready by November 22nd. Adding to Grant's worry was that hard fighting had broken out in Knoxville. He knew Lincoln and Stanton chafed in suspense over Burnside's fate, and that he would be compelled to provide some relief. He also worried that Bragg might break loose from Chattanooga and rush to join the fray against Burnside. Longing to fight Bragg now, Grant found delay insupportable, telling Halleck that, I have never felt such restlessness before as I have at the fixed and immovable condition of the Army of the Cumberland, a dig at George Thomas. Meanwhile, scruffy Confederate soldiers languished in woeful misery that made the plight of Union forces look like paradise in comparison. The soldiers were starved and almost naked, and covered all over with lice and camp itch and filth and dirt, wrote the Confederate soldier Sam Watkins. The men looked sick, hollow-eyed, and heartbroken, living principally upon parched corn which had been picked out of the mud and dirt under the feet of officers' horses. Early in the afternoon of November 23rd, the Army of the Cumberland under George Thomas swept across the open plain in front of Missionary Ridge and overran a small cluster of hills, including an elevation called Orchard Knob, that gave Grant the perfect command post for the coming battle. The next day, all of the interlocking pieces of his strategy began to unfold, albeit with critical improvisations along the way. On the cold, rainy morning of November 24th, Sherman ordered his four divisions to cross a swollen Tennessee River with pontoons and occupy the undefended northern end of Missionary Ridge. It turned out to be sheer illusion that he had staked out a piece of the ridge called Tunnel Hill. Whether from defective maps or Sherman's having misread the geography, his men had conquered a freestanding hill, detached from the main ridge by a deep ravine. At a separate command post, he was initially unaware of what had happened and reported a successful move to Grant. Because of this error, Grant was fooled about the precise location of Sherman's army and sent an erroneous message of triumph to Thomas. General Sherman carried Missionary Ridge as far as the tunnel with only slight skirmishing. The day's most scintillating action belonged to Joe Hooker. Tall, muscular, and ramrod straight, with blue eyes and tousled hair, he seemed perfectly cast as a general, with a self-confidence that many found appealing, but that also savored of self-promotion. A West Point general who fought in Mexico, he had failed in farming and engineering on the West Coast before the war plucked him from obscurity. Boastful, unable to muzzle opinions, he had waded into troubled waters with indiscretions. After he said the North needed a dictator, President Lincoln, who had appointed him commander of the Army of the Potomac, cautioned him, "Of course, it was not for this, but in spite of it, that I have given you the command." In many ways, the hard-drinking Hooker, whose louche headquarters were called a combination of bar room and brothel, stood poles apart from the prudish Grant. Right on the eve of the Chattanooga battle, Grant tried to get rid of Hooker and only held back because he had been sent by Lincoln. In his memoirs, Grant admitted that he regarded the egomaniacal Hooker as a dangerous man. He was not subordinate to his superiors. He was ambitious to the extent of caring nothing for the rights of others. On the morning of November 24th, Hooker flung parts of three divisions against Confederate forces on Lookout Mountain. The scene couldn't have been more picturesque or forbidding for Union troops. The steep mountain was lined with chasms, rocks, and fallen trees, and ringed with trenches and rifle pits. The battle was fought through sporadic haze, mist, and rain that at first veiled the upward movement of Hooker's men. "But the sound of his artillery and musketry was heard incessantly," wrote Grant, who watched from his command post at Orchard Knob. Clad in black hat and coat, his trousers tucked into Wellington boots, Grant squatted and wrote dispatches while balancing his order book on one knee, sending messages to reinforce Hooker and cut off any enemy retreat. At other moments, he sat on a stool behind a log barrier, calmly watching the action. One British journalist recorded his peerless tranquility. "There he stood in his plain citizen's clothes, looking through his double field glasses, apparently totally unmoved. I stood within a few feet of him, and I could hardly believe that here was this famous commander, the model, it seemed to me, of a modest and homely but efficient Yankee general." Grant always considered the pageantry of the Chattanooga fight beyond anything he had experienced, telling Washburn it was the first battlefield I have ever seen where a plan could be followed, and from one place the whole field be within one view. Once Hooker ascended the western face, he circled Lookout Mountain to take the northern slope, driving away Confederate soldiers. The peak was high enough that clouds congregated at lower levels, with Hooker's men intermittently visible above them. Hence the colorful label attached to the conflict, the Battle Above the Clouds. Grant, who praised Hooker's handling of the maneuver, denied that fierce fighting ever took place. "The Battle of Lookout Mountain is one of the romances of the war," he scoffed. "There was no such battle, and no action even worthy to be called a battle on Lookout Mountain. It is all poetry." When Hooker later heard such comments, he resented what he saw as an attempt to demean his achievement, saying he could account for it in no other way than that Grant was in his cups. Hooker had dexterously used feints and deceptions to coax rebel forces off the mountainside. As darkness descended, the sky was clear, a full moon shone, except for a lunar eclipse, and Union campfires dotted the slope in brilliant array. During the night, the last Confederate forces on Lookout Mountain melted away, rushing to the asylum of their comrades on Missionary Ridge. The next morning, Hooker's men planted the American flag atop the summit, drawing universal hurrahs from Union troops down below. On November 25th, a bright and glorious day, Sherman's army attacked the enemy, colliding with a small but proficient force under General Patrick Cleburne and absorbing numerous casualties. For many hours, the Army of the Tennessee made little headway, fighting fiercely at close range. Sherman was thus stymied in his quest for glory. "Go signal Grant," he instructed a staff officer at mid-afternoon. "The orders were that I should get as many as possible in front of me, and God knows there are enough. They've been reinforcing all day." At the southern end of Missionary Ridge, Joseph Hooker was delayed when rebels retreating from Lookout Mountain burned a key bridge across Chattanooga Creek, costing Hooker 4 precious hours. Originally, Grant hoped Sherman would reap the lion's share of glory at Chattanooga, but with Sherman and Hooker stalled at the far ends of Missionary Ridge, Grant turned his attention to George Thomas at the rebel center. He ordered Thomas, with his 23,000 troops, to grab the base of Missionary Ridge and seize the first line of enemy rifle pits on the lower portion. He held modest expectations, since the ridge was steep, well fortified, and seemingly impregnable. Union soldiers would have to march across a perilously exposed plain, then overtake the lowest rifle pits at the foot of the ridge. 1 hour after Grant gave the order to march, the slow-moving Thomas still had not complied. When he saw Thomas conversing with Thomas Wood, a division commander, Grant gave way to an uncommon moment of pique. Summoning Wood, he said, "I ordered your attack an hour ago. Why has it not been made?" "I have been ready for more than an hour," Wood said defensively, "and can attack in 5 minutes after receiving the order." Grant shot back, "I order you to attack." Triggered by a signal, 6 consecutive cannon shots, nearly 23,000 men sprang forward with lusty cheers. They moved with panache, urged on by rolling drums and bugle calls, their long, undulating columns and gleaming weapons providing a splendid spectacle in the afternoon sunshine. 50 guns opened fire on them from the ridge. Far from being disheartened, as Grant had feared, Thomas's army was stimulated to superior performance. Relegated to an ancillary role, they had something to prove and made quick work of the first rung of rifle pits. "The troops moved under fire with all the precision of veterans on parade," an elated Grant informed Halleck. Many Confederate defenders stood in poor condition, one observer describing them as rough and ragged men with no vestige of a uniform. Grant had good reason to crow about his men. "The assaulting column advanced to the very rifle pits of the enemy and held their position firmly, without wavering." All the while, Grant maintained his nonchalant, no-nonsense manner. "He seems perfectly cool," wrote William Renshaw Smith, "and one could be with him for hours and not know that any great movements were going on." Then, as Grant watched through field glasses, something unexpected, indeed miraculous, happened. 3 blue-coated regiments found themselves on a spur of the ridge hidden from enemy soldiers peering down from the top. As Confederates at the lower level started a panicky retreat up the mountainside, Union men, by a common impulse, began to clamber up after them, their regimental colors streaming in the wind. many Federals fled higher to avoid enemy fire. Before long, 18,000 blue-clad soldiers raced helter-skelter up the steep slopes. According to one version of the battle, it was the lowly soldiers who first heeded the impulse to scamper upward, and their superiors who belatedly followed. Bravery was suddenly the path of least resistance. The Northerners taunted the fleeing rebels with derisory cries of "Chickamauga! Chickamauga!" the humiliating defeat they sought to avenge. All the while, surging Union forces were saved from fire because Confederate marksmen feared they might accidentally spray with bullets their retreating comrades down below. Before long, 60 regimental Union flags streaked up the mountainside toward the crest, chevrons of flying soldiers floating upward in an infectious outbreak of mass courage. As they scrambled hastily for cover, Confederate soldiers left behind a trail of cannon, wagons, horses, and supplies. One Union commander who reveled in the thrilling ascent was Phil Sheridan, who flapped his hat in the air and brandished his sword. "Forward, boys, forward," he admonished his men. "We can go to the top. Come on, boys, give 'em hell." At the mountain peak, it was young Arthur MacArthur, Jr. of Wisconsin, father of World War II General Douglas MacArthur, who drove in the first regimental flag. Agog, Grant later admitted he had never seen anything like this extemporaneous rout of the enemy. Originally, he had expected his men to pause at the first trenches, regroup, then climb up the mountain in orderly stages, and he was initially disconcerted by the spontaneous upward push. "Thomas, who ordered those men up the ridge?" he demanded. "I don't know," said Thomas, his voice level. "I did not." Not about to argue with such success, Grant clamped down hard on an unlit cigar and decided not to countermand the impulsive action. "The boys feel pretty good," he observed. "Let them alone a while." He then gave orders for the entire line to storm the ridge. Entranced by the amazing occurrence in progress, Grant hurried off a message to Sherman. "Thomas has carried the hill and line in his immediate front. Now is your time to attack with vigor. Do so." By the end, ground observers saw one regimental color after another unfurled on the summit. Grant was astonished at how few casualties his men had endured. "I can account for this only on the theory that the enemy's surprise at the audacity of such a charge caused confusion and purposeless aiming of their pieces," he wrote. Once Grant saw the last Confederate defenses crumple, he spurred his horse to the front. He always considered Shiloh and Missionary Ridge his two most satisfying battles. As he rode along the ridgetop, he was cheered by jubilant troops with "tumultuous shouts," said Dana, who described the storming of the ridge as one of the greatest miracles in military history. Grant thought Bragg might stand and fight, but he was already in headlong retreat, fleeing into nearby Georgia. "An army never was whipped so badly as Bragg was," exulted Grant, who regretted not having captured the opposing army and thought he could have done so had he known the geography better. Nonetheless, Grant had accomplished his foremost objective, pushing Bragg into Georgia and away from Burnside in Knoxville. As befit a battle marked by theatrics, Bragg's escape sketched a memorable tableau. "Bragg is in full retreat, burning his depots and bridges," Dana told Stanton. "The Chickamauga Valley, for a distance of 10 miles, is full of the fires lighted in his flight." One Union soldier recorded thousands of rebel soldiers fleeing in a disorderly rout down the rear slope of Missionary Ridge, jettisoning battle paraphernalia in their haste. "Gray-clad men rushed wildly down the hill into the woods, tossing away knapsacks, muskets, and blankets as they ran." For Braxton Bragg, the disgrace was total. "Bragg looked scared," one Confederate soldier remarked. "He had put spurs to his horse and was running like a scared dog. Poor fellow, he looked so hacked and whipped and mortified and chagrined at defeat." When Bragg forwarded his resignation to Richmond, the Confederate government hastened to accept it. Endearing himself to Grant, Sheridan and his men pursued Bragg to his supply depot at Chickamauga Station, a quick-witted decision that yielded a windfall in prisoners and weaponry. Ecstatically joyful, Sheridan straddled one cannon, waved his hat, and emitted a loud cheer. Luckily for Bragg, nightfall made it difficult to overtake the defeated rebels. Grant chased Bragg as far as Ringgold, Georgia, 20 miles southeast of Chattanooga. Eli Parker, a newcomer to Grant's staff, was struck by the relentless way Grant rode, unfazed by bullets whistling around him. "When at Ringgold, we rode for half a mile in the face of the enemy, under an incessant fire of cannon and musketry. Not once do I believe did it enter the general's mind that he was in danger. He requires no escort beyond his staff. Roads are almost useless to him, for he takes shortcuts through field and woods, and will swim his horse through almost any stream that obstructs his way. He will ride from breakfast until 1 or 2 in the morning, and that, too, without eating." As was his wont, Grant proved generous in victory. When he and his officers trotted past a downtrodden contingent of enemy prisoners, he reacted with simple decency. "When General Grant reached the line of ragged, filthy, bloody, despairing prisoners, he lifted his hat and held it over his head until he passed the last man of that living funeral cortege," recalled a prisoner. "He was the only officer in that whole train who recognized us as being on the face of the earth." Once again, the man badly stereotyped as a butcher showed more sensitivity toward his fallen adversaries than his colleagues. Grant's reputation zoomed to new heights after Chattanooga. Within a month, he had done what seemed impossible. He had gone from being besieged by opponents to ejecting them, and his victory had pried open more rebel territory to Union penetration. Grant and his colleagues had cleaned out the enemy from most of Tennessee, laying the groundwork for a critical incursion into Georgia. "The slave aristocracy broken down," trumpeted Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs. "The grandest stroke yet struck for our country." In New York, George Templeton Strong pronounced the Chattanooga campaign the heaviest blow the country has yet dealt at rebellion. Grant thought his victory had driven a big nail in the coffin of rebellion. Southerners recognized that if they couldn't hold Chattanooga with its many natural advantages, they would have trouble resisting the Union juggernaut in future encounters. For the first time, Grant had taken elements of three Union armies, the Army of the Tennessee, the Army of the Cumberland, and the Army of the Potomac, and merged them into a cohesive fighting force despite rivalries that sometimes strained relations between Western and Eastern soldiers. "So far as I can understand the subject," wrote the historian John Lothrop Motley, "Ulysses Grant is at least equal to any general now living in any part of the world, and by far the first that our war has produced on either side." As Grant reached a new apogee of fame, his praise was echoed in newspapers that had criticized the war effort, the New York Herald maintaining that "General Grant is one of the great soldiers of the age, without an equal in the list of generals now alive." The sweetest praise arrived in a letter from Washington. "I wish to tender you and all under your command my more than thanks, my profoundest gratitude, for the skill, courage, and perseverance with which you and they, over so great difficulties, have effected that important object. God bless you all. A. Lincoln." All along, Grant had worried about Ambrose Burnside in Knoxville, having vowed to send him speedy relief after disposing of Bragg. On November 23rd, Burnside sent Grant an alarming report that he had only 10 or 12 days of supplies left, at the expiration of which he would need to surrender to Longstreet. "Do not be forced into a surrender by short rations," Grant beseeched him. "Take all the citizens have to enable you to hold out yet a few days longer." Grant decided to send 20,000 soldiers to break the siege, one column consisting of Sherman and his men, who were exhausted from the tough assignment at Chattanooga. In a shrewd bit of psychological warfare, Grant outlined for Burnside the steps he had taken to raise the siege, deliberately allowing it to fall into Longstreet's hands. The ruse worked. The day after receiving the letter, Longstreet gave orders to lift the Knoxville siege and return to Virginia, realizing Lincoln's long-held dream of regaining control over eastern Tennessee with its strong pro-Unionist elements. When Sherman arrived in Knoxville, he discovered that Grant had been badly bamboozled by Burnside, who had warned that his men faced starvation. Instead, Sherman found Burnside luxuriating amid plenty, with access to a fine herd of cattle. Burnside and his staff had taken up residence in a handsome mansion. Instead of finding bare cupboards, Sherman sat down to a generous dinner of roast turkey. When he told Burnside he expected to find him starving, the abashed Burnside confessed he had been able to obtain a good supply of beef, bacon, and cornmeal from the surrounding countryside. Hating to keep his army idle for extended periods, Grant immediately conceived new plans for taking Mobile. He wanted to steer his army down the Mississippi to New Orleans, then move east to Pascagoula in southeastern Mississippi, and strike at Mobile in the Georgia and Alabama interiors. The idea was vintage Grant, moving beyond isolated battles to a boldly expansive blueprint for taking state after state and terminating hostilities. His great strength was that he thought in terms of sequence of battles. However meritorious, his plan was vetoed by Lincoln, Stanton, and Halleck, who feared it might leave eastern Tennessee vulnerable and reverse recent success there. By this point, Lincoln stood firmly in Grant's corner, especially since his Tennessee victories had aided Republicans in carrying pivotal elections in Iowa and Ohio. "No man can feel more kindly and more grateful to you than the president," Washburn told Grant. Once Lincoln received word that Chattanooga and Knoxville lay safely in Union hands, he advised the northern public to congregate in churches and praise the Lord for this great advancement of the national cause. After many hideous bloodbaths, Lincoln felt grateful that Knoxville was liberated without more slaughter. In Washington, politicians vied to decorate Grant, and both houses of Congress passed unanimous resolutions thanking him for the eastern Tennessee victories. On December 18th, Lincoln asked Washburn to supervise the forging of a commemorative gold medal for Grant, while the citizens of Joe Davis County decided to give him a diamond-hilted sword, the names of his victories engraved on its gold scabbard. For all his hand-wringing over the flawed generals running the Army of the Potomac, Lincoln hesitated to bring Grant east, reluctant to dislodge him from the scene of so many stunning victories. "I do not think it would do to bring Grant away from the West." One reason Lincoln resisted any impulse to elevate Grant was the sudden chatter about Grant as a presidential candidate, perhaps inevitable for a conspicuously successful general. That November, Lincoln began to entertain more openly the idea of a second term, but his re-election, or even renomination, was no foregone conclusion. He had to reckon with the prospect that George McClellan might be the Democratic nominee, and he did not care to groom another possible military rival. The man banging the drum most loudly for Grant was James Gordon Bennett, the self-aggrandizing editor of the New York Herald, who editorialized that "the whole country looks up to Grant as the great genius who is to end this war, restore the Union, and save us from the danger which the end of the war may bring upon us." The pro-Grant boom that germinated in December 1863 enjoyed no support from its supposed beneficiary, who was aghast at being thrust into the political spotlight. When approached by the chairman of Ohio's Democratic State Central Committee to be the presidential candidate of the War Democrats, Grant promptly squelched such scuttlebutt. "I do not know of anything I have ever done or said which would indicate that I could be a candidate for any office whatever within the gift of the people. Nothing likely to happen would pain me so much as to see my name used in connection with a political office." Knowing it would find its way to the White House, Rawlins chimed in with a letter to Washburn that Grant was unambitious for the honor of the presidency. On a train trip that winter, Grant explained to the wife of a Union officer why he preferred his generalship over the presidency. "That is for life, and my family would be provided for." No minor consideration for a man who had suffered such economic uncertainty. The person who eased Lincoln's late-night worries about Grant's electoral plans was J. Russell Jones, a U.S. Marshal in Chicago and an intimate friend of Grant's who managed his investments. As speculation about a Grant candidacy gathered steam in January, Jones urged Grant to tamp down such talk. He thought that, with patience, Grant would be appointed lieutenant general, smoothing his way to the presidency 4 years later. In response, Grant spiked any discussion of his political leanings. "I am receiving a great deal of that kind of literature, but it soon finds its way into the wastebasket. I already have a pretty big job on my hands, and my only ambition is to see this rebellion suppressed. Nothing could induce me to think of being a presidential candidate, particularly so long as there is a possibility of having Mr. Lincoln re-elected." By disavowing any political agenda and reaffirming his loyalty to Lincoln, Grant showed his political astuteness. He already knew how to send clear but discreet political messages. Jones received this missive just as he set out for Washington to meet Lincoln, whom he found brooding about Grant's political intentions. As they sat alone in the White House, Jones gave Grant's letter to the president, who pored over it with infinite care, finishing with "a deep sigh of relief," according to Jones. Then, putting both hands on my shoulders, he said, "My son, I can't tell you how deeply gratified I am. You don't know how deep the presidential maggot can gnaw into a man's brain." It made a remarkable statement about Grant's meteoric ascent that Lincoln now warily appraised the former Galena store clerk as a potential competitor. One person who obsessed about Grant's rise to power was Sherman. Historians always laud their fraternal wartime bond, but where the affection was unalloyed on Grant's part, Sherman developed unspoken reservations about Grant. When he returned home to Ohio that December, he saw Grant catapulted to a new plateau of celebrity. "Our army is on all lips," he told Grant, "and were you to come to Ohio, you would hardly be allowed to eat a meal from the intense curiosity to see you and hear you." Sherman always made sarcastic comments about politicians and feared Grant would be corrupted by power. "Your reputation as a general is now far above that of any man living," he reassured Grant, "and partisans will maneuver for your influence, but if you can escape them, as you have hitherto done, you will be more powerful for good than it is possible to measure." This letter marked the start of a slow-motion schism between the two men, for Grant, unlike Sherman, had political ambitions and later allowed himself to be swept into office. Sherman also harbored some secret doubts about Grant as a general, not so much in individual battles, but as a possible chieftain of the overall war effort. "Grant has qualities Halleck doesn't," he told his brother, Senator John Sherman, "but not such as would qualify him to command the whole army." Whatever Sherman's reservations, Elihu Washburn shared none of them and lionized his protege. So outsized were Grant's victories that many Washington admirers thought he merited a rank higher than a mere major general. On December 14th, Washburn presented a bill in the House to resurrect the grade of lieutenant general, a rare honor conferred only on George Washington and by brevet on Winfield Scott. Grant was clearly intended as the recipient, which would jump him above Halleck to the pinnacle of military power. "I want Grant in a position where he can organize final victory and bring it to our armies and put an end to this rebellion," declared Senator James Doolittle of Wisconsin. Grant, having done nothing to provoke this, played the bashful hero, disclaiming ambition, and telling Washburn, "I have been highly honored already by the government and do not ask or feel that I deserve anything more in the shape of honors or promotion. A success over the enemy is what I crave above everything else." Contrary to Grant's wishes, the Lieutenant General bill spurred further speculation about him as a presidential candidate. Now persuaded that Grant didn't hanker after the presidency, Lincoln had no qualms about backing the Lieutenant General bill. On December 20th, Grant relocated his headquarters to Nashville, a good spot for overseeing military operations in his jurisdiction that also enjoyed excellent telegraphic communication with Washington. During a winter respite in the fighting, Grant devoted his attention to mapping out future campaigns against Atlanta, Montgomery, and Mobile, as his thoughts bent decidedly toward the eastern seaboard, the core of Confederate industrial strength. "Let us crush the head and heart of the rebellion," he told Halleck, "and the tail can be ground to dust or allowed to die. All possible results that cannot be gained by moving west will accrue necessarily when our objects are gained in the east." Grant's main organizational concern was to guarantee supplies for his armies for their spring campaigns. Just how capable he was is shown in the recollections of Colonel James Rustling of the Quartermaster's Department. He found Grant's appearance unprepossessing, with an unbuttoned coat and a battered hat, reminiscent of a country storekeeper or a western farmer. Then Rustling beheld Grant's extraordinary grasp of military detail, how every night he knew precisely where the enemy was and what he was doing and what we were able to do and dare. He also noticed how decisively Grant acted under pressure. When brought a request for a major expenditure, Grant approved it with startling speed. Rustling asked Grant if he was sure he was correct. "No, I am not," Grant shot back. "But in war, anything is better than indecision. We must decide. If I am wrong, we shall soon find it out and can do the other thing. But not to decide wastes both time and money and may ruin everything." As part of his logistical emphasis that winter, Grant sought to ensure adequate supply routes for his armies. Never content to rely on second-hand information, he toured Chattanooga, Knoxville, and Lexington by way of the Cumberland Gap, which entailed hard riding over desolate, badly pitted roads. In general, he enjoyed rugged exercise, but the unsightly remains of war rendered it a grisly experience. The road over Cumberland Gap was strewn with debris of broken wagons and dead animals, much as I had found it on my first trip to Chattanooga. The road had been cut up to as great a depth as clay could be by mules and wagons, and in that condition, frozen. The road was a very cheerless one and very disagreeable. Grant was heartened to see loyal admirers lining the route and was amused by their mistaken reaction to his entourage. The people naturally expected to see the commanding general, the oldest person in the party. I was then 41 years of age, while my medical director was gray-haired and probably 12 or more years my senior. The crowds would generally swarm around him and thus give me an opportunity of quietly dismounting and getting into the house. Despite Grant's self-effacing description, the ride illustrated what Sherman had recently said. Grant was now a national hero and viewed as a future president. As a colleague recalled, "Hail to the chief," both words and air greeted him at every stopping place. The winter provided a needed reprieve for Grant, allowing him to spend time in Nashville with Julia, who had been living in Louisville, because "it was not particularly pleasant for me at Father Grant's house," as she expressed it. During that frigid winter, Nashville provided few distractions from war. As Rawlins wrote, "If ever there was a city over which the shadow of gloom hung darkly, it is this. It is literally the city of woe. 19 out of 20 of the inhabitants are in mourning for friends who have been killed in battle." The kind-hearted Julia, deeply moved by the plight of wounded and dying soldiers, thought of little else. "I went to visit the hospitals on several occasions and saw many sad sights," she said. "I returned each time laden with petitions for discharges." Then she discovered that her overworked husband, who needed a break from the unbearable grimness of war, chided her for bringing home distressing tales from sick wards. I hear of these all day long, and I sent for you to come that I might have a rest from all this sad part. I do not want you to know about these things. I want you to tell me of the children and yourself. I want and need a little rest and sunshine." Sympathetic to her husband's deep-rooted sadness about the war, so visible in wartime pictures of him, Julia stopped visiting the hospitals, and they often attended a small Methodist church together. In Nashville, Grant pursued the incorporation of black soldiers into his army. In his year-end address to Congress, Lincoln boasted that 100,000 former slaves now participated in military service, about half bearing arms, and he credited them with a goodly share of Union victories. Around the same time, when Grant recommended the appointment of Brigadier General Augustus L. Chetlin to command black troops, Lincoln seconded this choice. Chetlin's job was to recruit and organize colored troops in Tennessee and West Kentucky. In discussing the assignment with Grant, Chetlin found him a wholehearted convert to Lincoln's policy. He then said that it was the policy of the government, which he fully endorsed, to place a large force of colored troops in the service at once, that the experiment of using colored men in the South in the Army so far had proved satisfactory. After a pause, he added, "I believe the colored man will make a good soldier." That winter, Grant also expanded the use of black troops to guard plantations on the west side of the Mississippi River. Grant had allowed his eldest son, Fred, to join him during the Vicksburg campaign. During the siege, Fred had contracted typhoid fever that only worsened in subsequent months. In late January, Grant sped off to St. Louis, where Fred's condition had grown perilous. He was so pessimistic that he did not expect to find his son still alive. The military situation in eastern Tennessee unavoidably detained him. Longstreet had resumed menacing activities in that end of the state. But by the time Grant saw Fred, he was on the mend, if still looking skeletal. Once given proper medications, Fred recovered at such a rapid pace that he returned to Nashville with his parents. While in St. Louis, Julia consulted Dr. Charles A. Pope to see if he could possibly correct her strabismus, a serious enough problem that it caused her physical distress and interfered with travel. But he said it was too late in life to perform this operation. When she mentioned the visit afterward to her husband, he was thunderstruck as to what had made her entertain such an idea. "Why, you are going to be such a great man, and I am such a plain little wife," Julia replied. "I thought if my eyes were as others are, I might not be so very, very plain, Ulysses. Who knows?" Grant's response was piercingly tender. "Did I not see you and fall in love with you with these same eyes? I like them just as they are. And now remember, you are not to interfere with them. They are mine. And let me tell you, Mrs. Grant, you had better not make any experiments, as I might not like you half so well with any other eyes." The anecdote, as well as many others, attests to the depth of Grant's unconditional love for his wife, and vice versa. Ulysses and Julia Grant received proof in St. Louis that they had been transformed into significant public figures. One night they attended the theater to see a drama called Richelieu, and sat far enough back in their box that the audience didn't realize until intermission that Grant was there. At that point, they took up a chant, "Grant! Grant! Get up!" He finally got up and made an awkward bow, but the crowd wouldn't stop cheering until he brought his seat to the front edge of the box, making him visible to the entire house. Two nights later, Grant was feted at the new Lindell Hotel, where Colonel Dent joined the admiring throng. The colonel, now a white-haired old man, listened as nine major and brigadier generals and numerous orators extolled his son-in-law's victories. Grant warmly greeted old friends and responded modestly to their sustained applause, a typically inscrutable expression on his face. Incapable of making a speech when a toast was given, "Gentlemen," he replied, "it will be impossible for me to do more than thank you." He stood and lit a cigar to the crowd's delight. Waiters kept placing wine glasses at Grant's side from which he would not partake. "I dare not touch it," he told General John M. Schofield. "Sometimes I can drink freely without any unpleasant effect. At others, I could not take even a single glass of wine." Schofield, impressed, thought, "A strong man indeed, who could thus know and govern his own weakness." Afterward, a huge crowd gathered outside Grant's hotel as celebratory bonfires burned and rockets streaked skyward. Grant appeared on the balcony to acknowledge the great fuss made over him. It must have been hard for his St. Louis friends to believe that this man, who had left town destitute a few years earlier, now rode such a wave of national adulation. One person who followed Grant's growing fame with apprehension was John Rawlins, who behaved like a nervous mother fretting over a potentially wayward son. When traveling on a train with Grant in Kentucky, two St. Louis society ladies tried to push a bottle of wine on Grant, which he refused. Grant's physician, Dr. Kitto, described Rawlins' outraged reaction. "Rawlins watched his chief with fear and trembling lest he should yield to the temptation, and gave vent to his indignation at the course pursued by the St. Louis females in terms more profanely forcible than elegant, and in so loud a tone that the two objects of his wrath plainly heard what he said, and bore evidence of their mortification by their looks." The ever-watchful Rawlins feared Grant had given way to drink at the festive St. Louis dinner, and was relieved when he returned unharmed to Nashville. "I feared everything was not as it should be with him, but his appearance has agreeably disappointed me, and for once I have done him injustice in my thoughts," he wrote. One reason Rawlins thought so despondently about Grant may have been his depressed view of his own medical condition. He was beginning to suspect that his long-standing cough might mean that, like his first wife before him, he was infected with tuberculosis. He would shortly leave on an extended Western trip to try to recapture his health. In the meantime, he consumed opiates to deal with the pain, complaining to his new wife that "the quantity of opium has affected my whole system inasmuch as to produce a sensation of numbness and drowsiness." When shown a photo of himself, he was taken aback to see himself looking sad and deathlike. Yet he admitted to Emma that the image was accurate, and that in every photo there was that same sad and sorrowful expression.